Welcome to the Beverage Report. Today, we have the honor of hosting one of the most respected and renowned experts in economic history and innovation studies, Calder Perez. As an economist, author, and speaker, Calder has contributed significantly to our understanding of technological revolutions and their impact on the economy and society. Her book, Technological Revolutions and Financial Capital, The Dynamics of Bubbles and Golden Ages, has been widely praised as a classic and is considered essential reading for anyone interested in the intersection of technology and economics. In addition to her academic accomplishments, Calder has also served as a centennial professor at the London School of Economics. We are very privileged to have Calder with us today and are eager to hear her perspectives on the current state of the technological revolution. Special thanks for this episode goes to Sylvia, Alice O'Donker, and the LSE Economics Department.
My first question to you is, what made you want to pursue a career as an academic and later as an international consultant?
Well, the first thing I can say is that I never planned to become an academic. It sort of happened to me. I was already 44 when I became an academic. I had studied architecture originally and left it 6 months before ending because I realized that wasn't what I wanted. My father was a civil engineer. My mother was a painter, an artist. So I probably did it because of them. But then I went into politics, and then I decided to study interdisciplinary studies in social sciences, economics, all these things. So I went to France. Actually, first I went to France, and then I discovered they had that. And then when I came back, I worked a little bit at the university in Venezuela, which is my country. And from there, I went to work for government, looking at the causes and consequences of the oil price hike. We were all shocked. I mean, why were we able to increase the price of oil so much? And nothing happened. Nobody invaded us. Nobody, you know. So it was very difficult to understand. But we also wanted to know what would be the consequences for us as oil producers. So I started looking into that. And that's actually how my theory began. Because I first discovered that every single technology in mass production was oil-based. That it was central. I mean, electricity, plastics, and all everything else. And as I looked into this, I suddenly found microelectronics. This was in the 70s, of course, in the mid 70s. So cheap microelectronics, and the list of things they said it could do, including reducing the use of oil, was amazing. And it was cheap, as cheap in relative terms as oil was. So I went and did a master's on that, on this thing which happened, which I understood as a sort of Kondratiev type long waves. I thought maybe that's what it was. And then when I came back, I didn't become an academic, even though I had a theory, my own theory in my hands. I wanted to save Venezuela from the worst consequences. I thought we had an opportunity with microelectronics, with the whole, what looked like a digital revolution. And I knew that this was already 1980, 81, when the rest of Latin America was having to open up because the IMF, because of debt and so on. Venezuela had oil, so we had a lease of life. We had a few years. And what I wanted was that, so I ended up creating an innovation center in the Ministry of Industry, something called the Directory of Technological Development, to work with companies, both public companies and private companies, to see if we could save those companies when we had to take protection off, because the whole of our industrialization had been under protection. And of course, it was all destroyed when the IMF forced everybody to open. Globalization never came to Latin America, it just went to Asia. But so what happened was that in the Ministry of Industry, trying to save companies, I couldn't make the government understand the risk we were taking. So I thought of inviting Chris Freeman from Sussex University, SPRU, the Science Policy Research Unit, which was at the time the holy grail of innovation studies. So I invited Chris Freeman and five others to give talks to convince the ministers, to convince government of what had to be done. And what happened was the opposite. He convinced me to come and present that theory in an event that he had 2 months later. So I did. And that's how I became an academic. At that time, I mean, I was invited to come to SPRU. And of course, Chris Freeman was my mentor, my sponsor, my colleague, and eventually, actually, my husband. So I fell into academia and have done nothing since, of course. But my theory also changed, because at first I just had the social institutional change. I thought with the changes in technology, we would need, I used the expression mismatch. There was a mismatch between the potential of the technology and the way that that government was organized, because you had to adapt to what it was that this potential was. But gradually I started discovering finance. This was especially when the boom in finance began, especially in the 90s, and especially in the bubble of the end of the 90s. So I actually understood that this whole relationship between financial capital and production capital was very important. And that's how my book came about. So my book came 20 years after the original sort of core of the theory. So, and my academic life began quite late. So that's the personal story.
It's been an incredible journey for you, and you've touched upon it a few times now, but before we delve a lot deeper into your academic work, could you please describe your framework for technological revolutions?
I think there are two questions there. Why does change happen by revolutions? That's a big question. And the second one, considering that change happens by revolutions, what's the pattern through which it happens? So my answer to the first question, why does change happen by revolutions, is that we are in a market economy. No other system works that way. The creative destruction process that goes on with every technological revolution is a very peculiar phenomenon of market economies. In fact, if you look at the USSR, which had a centralized economy, they also came to a point where they needed the technological revolution that the West developed. They had computers. They had everything. They had microprocessors. They did everything. But they couldn't do creative destruction. That only happens in market economies. So they collapsed almost invisibly, and they didn't develop the technological revolution that the West developed or any other. So the first thing to answer, why not continuous innovation? Because we see innovation happening in different areas, and apparently it's all discontinuous. I mean, it's all continuous. There is one here or there, and it happens all the time. But in fact, there is a set of interconnected opportunities. They are each revolution is a whole set that includes an infrastructure, includes a cheap factor that's at the core, like now microelectronics, like oil before, like steel before that, like coal before that. In each revolution, there is something that's very central and that's very cheap. So this structure is so interesting that it should have happened in that repeated way. But what the market economy needs is not only some things that change the relative cost structure by being very cheap and very powerful technologically, but also the interconnectedness of the whole set of technologies. There are products, there are technologies, there are methods, new ways of organizing. So it's actually a techno-economic paradigm. It involves relative cost structure and the technologies that go with them. What happens is that the more successful the new technologies are, the more people will do some of the same until they reach maturity. And when they reach maturity, the whole system starts finding that there are no more products along the same lines, that they cannot increase productivity anymore, therefore they cannot increase wages and they cannot reduce costs, and their markets become saturated. So at that point, what happens is that finance comes in and brings the new technologies by finding wherever they are. They bring them because they are about making money from money. So they need to invest, whereas the production people have knowledge and they don't want to part with it. So there is an inertia, natural inertia in the actual production sphere, whereas finance is crazy looking for new things because they want to make money. Of course, so does production, but production bases its capacity in its knowledge of the technologies, in its knowledge of the products, of the suppliers, of the consumers. So it's a knowledge-based thing, whereas finance is just a money, you know, the center of their power is money, not knowledge. So what happens then is what I just said, creative destruction. So the stagflation of the 70s, for instance, was about that maturity, therefore inflation coming because of maturity and stagnation because of maturity, both came together. And the new revolution was coming in. The microprocessor was 1971 in the middle of this thing, and the oil price hike was in 74. So all that transformation was in that turmoil of the 1970s. So that's my explanation of why, with some connection to how it happened this last time. But the question, the main question is that this doesn't just happen haphazardly. It happens in a certain, it follows a pattern. Each technological revolution in its diffusion follows a pattern. It begins by a turbulent period of creative destruction, which are called installation, because that's when you install the infrastructure, you install the techno-economic paradigm in the minds of people, you install all the various technologies and the suppliers and the distribution networks and all these things that are required for that particular set of technologies. And that period is turbulent because it ends in bubbles and collapses, because it brings inequality. It is always one about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. It's a very difficult time because creative destruction means destroying jobs, destroying skills, destroying industries, destroying regions. It's really about destruction and about creating all the new things, possibly in different places, with different skills, with different jobs, and so on. So that is the early period. That when you have the collapses, you have the reckoning. So that I call the turning point, because that's the moment when we go from finance capital determining what happens to production capital picking up on that potential and bringing it forward to healthy growth. But it's also that moment, that turning point, is the moment of protest, of resentment, of populism, of divisions in political parties, of tensions everywhere, and of new movements that emerge in that context, replacing what they think are inadequate political parties, inadequate leadership, and so on. People are angry, lots of people are angry, because somehow they have lost their hope. Resentment actually is a very peculiar feeling. It is about losing your future. So you're resentful because somebody has snatched away your future. That's why it very often falls on migrants, because they generally come and take the jobs that are now very badly paid, but they look like they're getting better. So there is this, but there is generally a lot of hate and resentment. Somebody must be guilty. So populism thrives in that atmosphere. That's why we're now having, because according to me, we're now in the turning point. So the During that turning point, it is obvious everything horrible that has happened comes to the surface. And then, finally, some enlightened leaders realize the need to save the system because it feels like the system is in danger. So that's when government sets up a positive sum game between business and society, which is when we have the golden ages. We have had the Victorian boom, the Belle Epoque, the post-war boom, and we might now have a sustainable information technology golden age. So this is what I have called the deployment period, which is when the new technologies go across the whole economy and also somehow provide benefit much more other layers of society, many more people than during the installation period. So this lifting of population to a better life lessens the tensions and creates hope and is all about growth with increasing productivity, with increasing well-being, not of everybody, but a much greater amount. The very first revolution only lifted the bourgeoisie and the merchants and so on. The aristocrats allowed them into the election system and so on. The second one lifted an educated layer of accountants and librarians and milliners and various other things. The third revolution lifted the whole of the skilled working class, and the mass production revolution lifted the blue collar workers. But that was only in the advanced world. It left out the developing world. So basically three periods: installation, turning point, and golden age deployment. That is the pattern that's followed, and that pattern each time ends with the maturity of the whole set of technologies and the need for a new one. And that's how the end of one technological revolution brings about the need for the next one in market economies.
That was super interesting. Now, based on your framework, previous golden ages, as you mentioned, were quite concentrated around Europe and the developed world, perhaps stretching to East Asia during the post-war period. Do you think the next golden age will encompass more regions due to globalization?
Definitely. Definitely. It depends on the technological revolution itself. There are some that are the concentrating type, like mass production. Mass production was about development within countries and only the ones that were capable to develop. And in fact, it's somehow that particular revolution depended on having a guarantee of low-cost energy and low-cost materials. So it was more about some people producing the low-cost materials than some other countries using them and increasing their productivity with that and increasing salaries and increasing capacity for consumption and so on. But there are other revolutions that are globalizing, like the third revolution, which began in the 1870s until the First World War. That one was actually, the first and the second had been only Great Britain, but all those technologies were there. So what happened in the first globalization was that with the steel railways that could be transcontinental, steel cables that made transoceanic telegraph possible, steel steamships, which made it possible to go up and down from north to south in 2 weeks, that created a sort of physical internet, if you want, which allowed food, materials, and other things to come from the south to the north very cheaply. The whole of the southern hemisphere was incorporated, and that includes Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, the whole of the southern hemisphere, plus Canada, the US. And of course, the US and Germany not only were incorporated, but they actually overtook Britain. They became, and because of the First World War being won by Britain and the US, then Germany did not become the leader, but it could have been. It could have been that Germany would have been the leader. So what happened was that those two countries actually were the Chinas of the time, the China and Japan, you know, the sort of being able to pick up on the other technologies and then do your own thing. So that one was globalizing, and this one is obviously also globalizing. By the way, at that time, Japan and Sweden also made a leap in development. So that was globalizing. And then we have this other one, which because of the Cold War was actually two systems. It was a bit complicated the way these mass production, which required very homogeneous population with the same language, with the same style of living, suburbanization, and the Cold War were the force at the directions in which the West developed. And that meant that the innovation and investment were all in the direction of mass production and mass consumption. And of course, weapons, which was the other thing, where much of the big innovations that brought the information revolution, such as computers and the internet, were developed. This time, I don't think we can have a golden age without full global development. I think it is the only way, because we can discuss a little bit more later, but basically that is where the markets for the advanced countries would come from, because you would have markets for capital goods, for infrastructure, for knowledge, for the things that can create employment in the North. I think also we need to have a rental economy, basically rental and maintenance, to revive that. That was destroyed in mass production in order for you to buy new each time. But we need to change the culture of consumption in order to be able to incorporate the whole world, which would be good for both sides. But we haven't understood that yet. We're very far from understanding, and it might not happen.
So the next question I have for you is, why has our installation phase lasted so long with a delayed golden age?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The first question, that also has, it sort of contains two questions. First of all, why does installation need to end? Couldn't we just continue on installation, having new things, experimenting, finance, investing like mad, and so on? And why does it need to end? And the other is, why has it been so much longer this time compared to previous times? So it needs to end because, being about creative destruction, the system enters a danger phase with real threats, increasing protests and populism. So it's a very dangerous period for the system, because it cannot resist so much destruction in order to the creation, the creative part. That's when, as I said, enlightened leaders realize the need to redesign the context. What they do is they understand the legitimacy of capitalism hinges on the increasing wealth of a few, leading to the betterment of the greater numbers. If you don't have that in capitalism, it's not legitimate. Why should you allow some people to become really, really rich and everybody else to become really, really poor all the time? Obviously, this inequality that we have been living through the past 3-4 decades is not possible. So the other question, so generally it lasts like 20-25 years at most, maybe 30 at most when it has a war in between. But it hasn't lasted like now more than 40 years. So why has it been longer this time? Well, first, as Rafi Kaplinsky has noted, China gave a lease of life to mass production. That made it possible to maintain the inequality trend through the 90s and noughties by increasing the real purchasing power of stagnant nominal wages. So people were able to buy clothing very cheaply, appliances very cheaply, a whole range of things were very cheap. Even if food didn't become much cheaper, everything else that made up the consumption thing became much cheaper. So that is one of the reasons that for the anger not coming so soon, because in fact, people did not feel the real weight of this inequality until much later. But by the teens, already after the 2008 crash, resentment erupted ferociously, and populism has been growing ever since, everywhere. But if we look at the actual reasons, not just that one, which sort of says anger came late, there are other things. Some are due to the nature of the technological revolution. This is the first one that instead of doing only manual work, mechanizing manual work, it's now mechanizing mental work. And that's a virgin field. To do mechanization of mental work is only now. So it's, you know, you begin and there is a whole range of things to go, even things like now being able to stream music, what we're doing now, the podcast, all these things are a part of a new way of thinking of mental work. And that has a whole long way to go still. The other thing is that it's a global one. So it is going to every country, many more than the first globalization and much deeper into each country than the first globalization. So it also takes longer. Plus, a very peculiar thing. This is the only case in which the infrastructure, in this case, the internet, of the revolution has not been the one that starts. Actually, the longest one, which was globalization, did have part of the infrastructure, which was electricity is actually more the infrastructure for the fourth. But during the third, it played an important role. But the steel, which made for the construction industry, for the steel, everything, the steamships and the whole communications transport infrastructure, that was there from the very beginning. And of course, the previous one began with the railways. So the very fact that the internet only came in 94, so from 71 to 94, we had no internet. It was the digital revolution without internet. So that again says something. So it's until 2008, so on, that more or less we really had a proper installation period with the tool and with the globalization that comes with it. No, but the most important reasons are not those. Those are, you know, okay, study the revolution and see, because each one is different and so on. The really, really serious ones have to do with the context and with the politics. One of them I already mentioned is the lease of life given to mass production by China, the growth of China, the growth of those markets. I mean, that has created a dynamism which wouldn't have been there if we had already reached the moment when the system cannot continue without bringing about a golden age. But the other thing, which is really, really dangerous, is finance. Global finance, the fact that finance has become completely global, decoupled from the real economy, which it always does in installation, but this time it's really decoupled. It makes money, it's just a casino and making money with money in the global stage. And also it's disconnected from national regulation. So finance really has been treated in a completely different way. In every previous case, they were both regulated and punished. Some people got punished, and regulation became very restrictive so that they would go back to funding the real economy. This time, quantitative easing, troubled asset, whatever program, money being thrown without conditionality. And because they have internet, which makes finance global, then that means that they have nobody to stop them and nobody to force them into actually helping the real economy. And deployment and golden ages are about the recoupling of finance and production. That's exactly what Keynes said in the 1930s, that there had never been such a deep separation between finance and production as they were there. And until they were recoupled, we would not have a decent economy. And that's exactly what is happening now. And that's why we are in the situation that we are. And we might not have a golden age. Britain did not have a golden age in the third revolution, in the first globalization I was talking about, while the Belle Époque in Europe and the Progressive Era in the US was actually a time of re-equalization. Britain didn't really do the job. They came in late, 1911, while the others had begun much later in making the conditions for golden age. So It is possible that we might not have it, and it would be a shame.
Looking forward, entering the next golden age requires government intervention to align society and businesses for investment and innovation. On what levels should governments cooperate to achieve this?
What they need to do is to make it profitable to invest and innovate in digital and green, but not so for high carbon footprint. So basically, you have to tilt the playing field, providing directionality. Directionality means that all the advantages are in a particular direction. You tilt the playing field. You make it so that people will compete in a context which already has advantages, general advantages in certain directions. I mentioned before that suburbanization and Cold War were the two main directions for innovation and investment. Now we should have smart, green, fair, and global growth. Smart, obviously, digital is the most powerful tools we have for everything. And that's how technologies transform society, is by bringing whatever the new technologies, which are very high productivity. Actually, you don't stop now artificial intelligence or robotics or whatever. There's always some part of the economy that's very, very high productivity. And that one generates enough wealth to have an enormous part of the economy, which is lower productivity, but uses some of those technologies, not always. And that creates the jobs, replaces the jobs that are lost, uses new skills. Old skills also, in some cases, are very important. So digital, green, obviously, because that is the direction. If we don't want to disappear as a species, we need to do green. But that's an opportunity rather than a threat. I will explain that at some point, I hope. Fair, because you have to reduce the inequality, reverse that process, and incorporate more people, possibly everybody in these countries, and global, because it would incorporate, would be full global development. And growth. I sort of feel uncomfortable when people propose that the solution is degrowth in order to achieve green, when actually with digital, we can increase productivity so much that we can do the growth with intangibles, with services, with all sorts of things that are, I mean, we can see that, for instance, the whole of film, of music, and we don't have records anymore. We don't need to have film as a, you know, we don't have the cassettes and all these things. We just bring it down from the computer. And so with a lot of the reading we do, so we are reducing the amount of material we use. That's the whole idea. Dematerialization is another part of what the future would mean, and that's part of the smart and global, incorporating everybody, I already said. So what governments do for a golden age is to create directions in which everybody goes. That means you have synergies, you have suppliers, you have people are used to you innovating in that direction, and therefore you have demand. But of course, in order to have demand, you also have to reduce inequality. So that would be the whole thing. And somehow we need to organize the interrelations in the global economy. It might end up being several poles, maybe three great things, or maybe two, we don't know. Or maybe we will all get together. That it depends on many things. We cannot know what geopolitics will bring. But it also has to be, I mean, globalization somehow has to be redesigned. Up to now, what it has done is just go to there, and it doesn't solve the problem of the countries from which industry left, and it doesn't solve the problem of the countries to which industry did not go, such as Latin America and Africa mainly. So we have a big thing ahead. Governments of all countries, and also governments together, because we need a multi-level governance. It's perhaps we cannot discuss that now, but we will need supranational authorities. It's the only way to control finance. We need supranational authorities probably to have a financial transactions tax with which to fund the greening of the South. There are many, many innovations to be done. And it's not just how government intervenes, but which are the conditions, which are the goals that governments are going to be pursuing with the various ways of innovative government action.
Shifting gears a bit now, what do you think of companies like Disney and Alphabet acquiring smaller competitors? Does this hinder the approach of a new golden age?
Well, monopolies, or at least oligopolies, have formed in every technological revolution and just about during the bubbles and after the bubbles, especially after the bubble collapses. If you think General Motors and Ford and Chrysler in the US, there were only three companies producing all the cars. 15 years before, there had been 44. So, you know, this happens. The swallowing of the little or the weaker by the big, this is a capitalist thing. This happens in the market. But of course, each time you have to see what you do. One of the things that was done with this oligopoly of these three companies was that labor unions were very much strengthened and they became industrial unions, so that instead of negotiating with Ford, with General Motors, and with Chrysler separately, where if somebody got more than the other company, that would mean that they have, that the ones that gave less to the workers would have an advantage. In this case, industry unions made that all auto workers, no matter what their trade, no matter what, they had the same conditions in the three companies. And Jeep also, anybody who was making cars was in this thing. And the same thing industry by industry. So this change from trade unions to industry unions was extremely important. That's the sort of innovation, that's intelligent innovation, that understands the conditions and manages an oligopoly, which was that case. A monopoly like AT&T. The negotiation with them was to set up Bell Labs and so on, because it was understood that the telephone company had to be just one. So you had a monopoly, but it was very much regulated. And they regulated prices, they discussed everything. So you have to create, you have to look at the specifics. And of course, in the previous revolution, in the third, just at the beginning of the fourth, you had oil, which was at first produced by many, many, many little companies, but gradually Rockefeller managed to put them all together to practically force them into his empire. And then his company was broken up. That was the solution at that point. So you had several oil companies coming out of that monopoly. So whatever is done has to be adequate to the specific conditions. And I would say that to find the appropriate way to regulate monopolies and oligopolies today, you need expert techies, people who are young, who are very much digital natives, and who can think of how to control this situation. Obviously, all little companies now, they're not looking for an IPO. They're looking for who's going to buy me and for how much, which is something you cannot avoid. But this is what has happened in a way, is that the big companies have outsourced innovation to the venture capitalists. I mean, if you look at it that way, you realize that that's their R&D is now in the hands of the venture capitalists who are funding these new startups that then, but obviously up to a point, you know, if you get like what happened with between Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram, that should not have been accepted. That's absurd. Companies that were already coming up and that could have been, they weren't little ones when they were swallowed. But anyway, there was this idea that markets are free, free markets, free markets, free markets, and all the horrible things that have happened due to free markets, we now have to deal with them. But yes, that is a problem, and it has to be dealt with every time in a specific way, in the way that fits whatever it is that you're regulating, and that needs understanding. It was very embarrassing to see Mark Zuckerberg being interviewed by the US Congress, where those people knew nothing about Facebook or about digital or about anything. It was embarrassing. We cannot have that. And one of the problems we have is that because we have longevity, everybody's living so long, the young don't get a chance. because people in their 80s are still perfectly active. It used to be that 65 was retirement age. Now it's 80 something. I myself, I'm 83 now and I'm not retiring. So we have a problem. We need the young. Normally, the young are the ones who are completely into the new paradigm. They cannot think the old way, whereas we find it very difficult to stop thinking the old way. That's why when we see these big companies absorbing the others, immediately we think we have to break them up. We have to forbid the... Maybe that is the solution. Maybe it's not. But we need fresh thinking by people who know how to handle the situation.
What do you think about the issue of internet companies being global, but government regulations usually being regional?
Yeah, that is not the worst of it. I think our the real problem is global finance. That's the main obstacle. If we could regulate global finance supranationally, if we could stop it from playing people to the bottom, it would be great. It would make a difference. And I don't think a golden age can come about without the capacity to regulate global finance. And once we can regulate global finance, all the other questions, the social media platforms, all these things can be handled in a somehow. We have to learn to act supranationally. Up to now, all things that are international are actually international. So you have everybody with their national interests fighting to get a level playing field for everybody. It's very difficult. We need supranationality to become a reality in a different way. That's not, you know, it's got to be really, we have to recognize which are the things that absolutely need supranational regulation and supranational power with bite, not like the UN or like, you know, these things which are really not, they don't have any power to act, they don't have any power to regulate, they don't have any power to constrain bad behavior. And that is, I realize that I'm asking for the moon. But without the moon, I don't think we'll ever have a golden age. It is very difficult. We can find little things. We can solve the Twitter problem or the Meta problem or, you know, one or the other. That it's possible, but we need something much bigger. And especially about finance.
You are also a strong proponent of transitioning to a green global age. This transition requires multi-level governance, redesign of the welfare state, and promotion of green lifestyles. Could you please expand on why these changes are important?
I'm going to turn them around and begin with green lifestyles. Every technological revolution has changed lifestyles. And the change in lifestyles isn't just a question of here are some technologies that allow you to live differently. It so happens that the lifestyles have being the essence of the golden ages, because they are the way in which you lift up all the ones that have been displaced and you create the new jobs and you create the new conditions. And when, because once you change lifestyles, that has an enormous amount of new demands, which are fulfilled by catering to them. So you have innovation and you have employment and you have investment to fulfill the needs of this new lifestyle. So we had the urban living of the Victorian boom. So the aristocrats used to live in the countryside and they had a style of living and a way of consuming, which was very different from the bourgeoisie and all the people who worked for the bourgeoisie and for the merchants and so on in the cities, where you had a way of living with very narrow houses, one next to the other and full of all sorts of things. And those all sorts of things and that construction and all that created jobs and created opportunities for everybody, while there were very high productivity and reducing the number of workers in the railways, the coal industry, chemicals, and of course textiles, which was the main textiles and everything around textiles. those are very high productivity, but the people who made the hats and the boots and the dresses and the furniture and the curtains and all those were jobs, wonderful jobs for all sorts of people. And that layer of population grew as a good life. They had a better life, much better than in the hungry 40s, which was in the 1840s, very, very difficult times. So that was the lifestyle. Then you had cosmopolitan lifestyle of the Belle Epoque, where you had a whole, you know, big, big cities, but then you had the whole catering. It was hospitality, it was hotels, cafes, bars, music halls, opera, theater, journals, magazines, posters, art, a whole world, mainly outdoors. And that was also created an enormous amount of jobs. And cities became very, very large. And then there was, of course, transportation and travel all over the world. And that was also a job creator. And at that time, of course, you also had the lifestyles, that lifestyle going to everywhere in Canada and Australia and the US and everywhere. They were all adopting these same lifestyles that created jobs in each of those countries. So that is an essential part of the golden age, the change of lifestyle. And of course, now what we need is green lifestyles, but we can't impose them. You do not get a lifestyle diffusing if by guilt or fear. That's absurd. We'll never get it. We need it to be by desire and aspiration. We need to be able to make green lifestyles the good life. That is the better life. We will feel proud, and it is about creativity. It's about health. It's about taking care of the planet, but also taking care of yourself. It's about it's a much nicer way of living than sitting in front of the TV set and going to the mall to do some shopping. So that is the idea of possession. We need to shift to rental so that we don't have, so that they products can last 100 years and go from one to the other, second hand, third hand, seventh hand, and it's still working, fantastic refrigerator that I can rent for £1 a month or $1, all the way down. And then at the end, you recycle it and you rescue the materials. We need to change all those things. So that's, yes, one very important change. Another important change is the change in the welfare state. It's not by chance that we have the gig economy. It's not by chance that we have the self-employed. It's not by chance that we're working from home and lots of people are working from home on their own. This is a revolution. This is about the changes in job structures and job styles that have to do with this technological revolution in particular. And, you know, if you make Uber turn every worker into an employee, then they close down. Why would they exist? They only exist because they can do this. So you have to think of a way of guaranteeing that these people who work, both the ones who work for Uber and the ones who work at home on their own, and nobody knows that they're working on their own, all need to have a welfare system that will guarantee. So you might need to make a sort of cooperative thing. Maybe the banks have to set it up and the government has to come in. And then Uber would contribute to this cooperative where people, depending on the hours they work or something, they would have a different. We have to think. We've got to think of a completely new way to do that. We already talked about basic income. That would be the floor, the cushion that saves everybody from hunger and whatever. So you can be self-employed with some guarantee from society and so on. So the welfare state as it is now is useless. There is a lot of work being done by Hilary Cottam on a change of the welfare state that goes towards the well-being of everybody in a participatory way, changing also the conditions of work and so on. It's interesting also to look at new, really new things, new ways of approaching. And the multi-level government, I already mentioned that the global, we don't always only have globalization, we have localization. Because what this has allowed, because of internet, is that you can actually, you can have locally generated electricity through renewables or biofuels if you need to compensate for the intermittence. You have the possibility of working from any corner of the globe to going to any corner of the globe. So the possibility of turning every locality into a sort of mini, you know, with an industrial, local industrial policy that would keep people there, not having to come to the slums in the cities and become this belt of misery that surrounds almost every city in the world, and particularly in the developing world. It is possible to think of globalization and localization, which means that we need to have, as I said before, supranational, national, regional, municipal, local, whatever, several layers in each country, depending on the size of the country, depending on the conditions. But it's very interesting that a time when federal governments were very typical was precisely the globalizing surge before, because you have this complexity that makes it more difficult to have a federal government. Whereas during mass production, which was a concentrating revolution, we tended to have very centralized federal governments, central national governments. So there is this change, and that is part of the transformation. It's a pretty big transformation. We need, you know, when you think of Bretton Woods as the moment when the mass production revolution was turned into a golden age, the IMF, the World Bank, with different names, but anyway, the GATT, the United Nations, all those things, plus unemployment insurance, pensions, a very important thing, which was to give the banks the guarantee that they could give mortgages to people employed, because even if they lost their job for a few months, there would be this cover of unemployment insurance so that they wouldn't have to return the keys of the car and of the house. So we had suburbanization with all those possibilities. And the government actually helping strongly, not only with the infrastructure, but also with those mechanisms. Because in fact, if you think of unemployment insurance as something that helped employees, you are only seeing half of the picture. It was for employees and for business, because business could then sell everything on credit without any problem, because if people lost their jobs, they could still continue paying. So that's the sort of thing. Those are the sort of elements from this positive sum game between business and society, which are quite important and not so easy to understand. What does that mean? Positive sum game between business and society. It means things like that. Unemployment insurance and pensions, because if you have a pension, you can spend all your income today because you know you have a pension. And such things, now there is total insecurity. People are not even sure that the money they actually saved is still there or will still be there when they need it. So the whole system has broken down, and that's what happens. A welfare state of one revolution does not survive into the next. It's got to be transformed.
Very fascinating. As we're coming towards like the end of our discussion here today, I want to ask, are there any books that you would recommend to our audience?
Well, I guess by this time, you know that I think the most important thing now is to bring the state back. So we need to know how to do it. And it's not in the same way as before. So what I would recommend reading are the books that deal with that. So Mariana Mazzucato's work, especially The Mission Economy, but also The Entrepreneurial State and The Value of Everything. Rafi Kaplinsky's Sustainable Futures, which is a whole looking at the whole thing from mass production until now, the transformation and how to do it. Then also a recent book by Cattell Dreschler and Caro called How to Make an Entrepreneurial State, Why Innovation Needs Bureaucracy. They go back to Weber's definition of bureaucracy as a very organized, creative, well-informed, well-educated public sector that's capable of making the necessary transformations, all those things. I would say that look at what they want, what people are proposing, people who are thinking forward in this innovative way. That those are the books I think people need to read. We need to spread the idea that with free markets and global finance controlling everything, we'll never get there. And capitalism is in danger. Populism is not by chance. Hitler and Stalin were the two left and right extremes that one said, get rid of the capitalists, and the other, get rid of the Jews. And they both were about getting angry about what was there. And we have a lot of people in those two extremes picking up on people's anger. So is this system going to survive? Is there another system that's better that would replace it? I don't think so. What we need is to fix this one. And there is plenty of possibilities to fix it. And reading books that say how to do it is one way to go about it.
A question we ask all our guests, what gives you hope?
I guess I am probably the most pessimistic optimist you'll ever know. So I am very hopeful because my study of history tells me that the brightest times have followed the darkest ones. So I hope it'll happen again.
Thank you so much, Professor Perez. It was a pleasure and an honor to have you on our podcast. And I hope that the listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.